For the New Intellectual by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 4. To the glory of mankind, there was for the first and only time in history a country of money, and I have no higher, more reverent tribute to pay to America, for this means a country of reason, justice, freedom, production, achievement. For the first time, man's mind and money were set free, and there were no fortunes by conquest, but only fortunes by work. And instead of swordsmen and slaves, there appeared the real maker of wealth, the greatest worker, the highest type of human being, the self-made man, the American industrialist. If you ask me to name the proudest distinction of Americans, I would choose, because it contains all the others, the fact that they were the people who created the phrase, to make money. No other language or nation had ever used these words before. Men had always thought of wealth as a static quantity, to be seized, begged, inherited, shared, looted, or obtained as a favor. Americans were the first to understand that wealth has to be created. The words to make money hold the essence of human morality. Yet these were the words for which Americans were denounced by the rotted cultures of the looters' continents. Now the looters' credo has brought you to regard your proudest achievements as a hallmark of shame, your prosperity as guilt, your greatest men, the industrialists, as blackguards, and your magnificent factories as the product and property of muscular labor, the labor of whip-driven slaves like the pyramids of Egypt. The rotter who simpers that he sees no difference between the power of the dollar and the power of the whip ought to learn the difference on his own hide, as I think he will. Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be the tool by which men deal with one another, these men become the tools of men. Blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice. There is no other. And your time is running out. The Martyrdom of the Industrialists. This is part of a conversation between Francisco D'Anconia and Hank Reardon, a self-made man who has risen to the position of the country's greatest steel industrialist. Francisco speaking. You who would not submit to the hardships of nature, but set out to conquer it and placed it in the service of your joy and your comfort, to what have you submitted at the hands of men? You who know from your work that one bears punishment only for being wrong, what have you been willing to bear, and for what reason? All your life you have heard yourself denounced not for your faults but for your greatest virtues. You have been hated not for your mistakes but for your achievements. You have been scorned for all those qualities of character which are your highest pride. You have been called selfish for the courage of acting on your own judgment and bearing sole responsibility for your own life. You have been called arrogant for your independent mind. You have been called cruel for your unyielding integrity. You have been called antisocial for the vision that made you venture upon undiscovered roads. You have been called ruthless for the strength and self-discipline of your drive to your purpose. You have been called greedy for the magnificence of your power to create wealth. You who've expended an inconceivable flow of energy have been called a parasite. You who've created abundance where there had been nothing but wastelands and helpless starving men before you have been called a robber. You who've kept them all alive have been called an exploiter. You, the purest and most moral man among them, have been sneered at as a vulgar materialist. Have you stopped to ask them by what right, by what code, by what standard? No. You have borne it all and kept silent. You bowed to their code and you never upheld your own. You knew what exacting morality was needed to produce a single metal nail, but you let them brand you as immoral. You knew that man needs the strictest code of values to deal with nature, but you thought that you needed no such code to deal with men. You left the deadliest weapon in the hands of your enemies, a weapon you never suspected or understood. Their moral code is their weapon. Ask yourself how deeply and in how many terrible ways you have accepted it. Ask yourself what it is that a code of moral values does to a man's life, and why he can't exist without it, and what happens to him if he accepts the wrong standard, by which the evil is the good? Shall I tell you why you're drawn to me, even though you think you ought to damn me? It's because I'm the first man who has given you what the whole world owes you, and what you should have demanded of all men before you dealt with them, a moral sanction. You're guilty of a great sin, Mr. Reardon, much guiltier than they tell you, but not in the way they preach. The worst guilt is to accept an undeserved guilt, and that is what you have been doing all your life. You have been paying blackmail, not for your vices but for your virtues. You have been willing to carry the load of an unearned punishment, and to let it grow the heavier the greater the virtues you practiced. But your virtues were those which keep men alive. Your own moral code, the one you lived by, but never stated, acknowledged, or defended, was the code that preserves man's existence. If you were punished for it, what was the nature of those who punished you? Yours was the code of life. What then is theirs? What standard of value lies at its root? What is its ultimate purpose? Do you think that what you're facing is merely a conspiracy to seize your wealth? You who know the source of wealth should know it's much more and much worse than that. Did you ask me to name man's motive power? Man's motive power is his moral code. Ask yourself where their code is leading you and what it offers you as your final goal. A viler evil than to murder a man is to sell him suicide as an act of virtue. A viler evil than to throw a man into a sacrificial furnace is to demand that he leap in of his own will, and that he build the furnace besides. By their own statement, it is they who need you and have nothing to offer you in return. By their own statement, you must support them because they cannot survive without you. Consider the obscenity of offering their impotence and their need of you, as a justification for your torture. Are you willing to accept it? Do you care to purchase, at the price of your great endurance, at the price of your agony, the satisfaction of the needs of your own destroyers? If you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with the last of his strength, and the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders, what would you tell him to do? I don't know. What could he do? What would you tell him? To shrug. The moral meaning of capitalism. This is a statement made by Hank Reardon at his trial for an illegal sale of a metal alloy which he had created and which has been placed under government rationing and control. I do not want my attitude to be misunderstood. I shall be glad to state it for the record. I work for nothing but my own profit, which I make by selling a product they need to men who are willing and able to buy it. I do not produce it for their benefit at the expense of mine, and they do not buy it for my benefit at the expense of theirs. I do not sacrifice my interests to them, nor do they sacrifice theirs to me. We deal as equals by mutual consent to mutual advantage. And I am proud of every penny that I have earned in this manner. I am rich and I am proud of every penny I own. I have made my money by my own effort, in free exchange and through the voluntary consent of every man I dealt with. The voluntary consent of those who employed me when I started. The voluntary consent of those who work for me now. The voluntary consent of those who buy my product. I shall answer all the questions you are afraid to ask me openly. Do I wish to pay my workers more than their services are worth to me? I do not. Do I wish to sell my product for less than my customers are willing to pay me? I do not. Do I wish to sell it at a loss or give it away? I do not. If this is evil, do whatever you please about me, according to whatever standards you hold. These are mine. I am earning my own living, as every honest man must. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact of my own existence, and the fact that I must work in order to support it. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact that I am able to do it, and to do it well. I refuse to accept as guilt the fact that I am able to do it better than most people, the fact that my work is of greater value than the work of my neighbors, and that more men are willing to pay me. I refuse to apologize for my ability. I refuse to apologize for my success. I refuse to apologize for my money. If this is evil, make the most of it. If this is what the public finds harmful to its interests, let the public destroy me. This is my code, and I will accept no other. I could say to you that I have done more good for my fellow man than you can ever hope to accomplish. But I will not say it, because I do not seek the good of others as a sanction for my right to exist. Nor do I recognize the good of others as a justification for their seizure of my property or their destruction of my life. I will not say that the good of others was the purpose of my work. My own good was my purpose, and I despise the man who surrenders his. I could say to you that you do not serve the public good, that nobody's good can be achieved at the price of human sacrifices, that when you violate the rights of one man, you have violated the rights of all, and a public of rightless creatures is doomed to destruction. I could say to you that you will and can achieve nothing but universal devastation, as any looter must when he runs out of victims. I could say it, but I won't. It is not your particular policy that I challenge, but your moral premise. If it were true that men could achieve their good by means of turning some men into sacrificial animals, and I were asked to immolate myself for the sake of creatures who wanted to survive at the price of my blood, if I were asked to serve the interests of society apart from, above and against my own, I would refuse. I would reject it as the most contemptible evil. I would fight it with every power I possess. I would fight the whole of mankind. If 1 minute were all I could last before I were murdered, I would fight in the full confidence of the justice of my battle, and of a living being's right to exist. Let there be no misunderstanding about me. If it is now the belief of my fellow men who call themselves the public that their good requires victims, then I say the public good be damned. I will have no part of it. The meaning of sex. This is from a conversation between Francisco D'Anconia and Hank Reardon, who are in love with the same woman, though neither one of them knows it. Francisco speaking. Do you remember what I said about money, and about the men who seek to reverse the law of cause and effect? The men who try to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind? Well, the man who despises himself tries to gain self-esteem from sexual adventures, which can't be done. Because sex is not the cause, but an effect and an expression of a man's sense of his own value. The men who think that wealth comes from material resources and has no intellectual root or meaning are the men who think for the same reason that sex is a physical capacity which functions independently of one's mind, choice, or code of values. They think that your body creates a desire and makes a choice for you. Just about in some such way as if iron ore transformed itself into railroad rails of its own volition. Love is blind, they say. Sex is impervious to reason and mocks the power of all philosophers. But in fact, a man's sexual choice is the result and the sum of his fundamental convictions. Tell me what a man finds sexually attractive, and I will tell you his entire philosophy of life. Show me the woman he sleeps with, and I will tell you his valuation of himself. No matter what corruption he's taught about the virtue of selflessness. Sex is the most profoundly selfish of all acts, an act which he cannot perform for any motive but his own enjoyment. Just try to think of performing it in a spirit of selfless charity, an act which is not possible in self-abasement, only in self-exaltation, only in the confidence of being desired and being worthy of desire. It is an act that forces him to stand naked in spirit as well as in body and to accept his real ego as his standard of value. He will always be attracted to the woman who reflects his deepest vision of himself, the woman whose surrender permits him to experience, or to fake, a sense of self-esteem. The man who is proudly certain of his own value will want the highest type of woman he can find, the woman he admires, the strongest, the hardest to conquer, because only the possession of a heroine will give him the sense of an achievement, not the possession of a brainless slut. He does not seek to gain his value, he seeks to express it. There is no conflict between the standards of his mind and the desires of his body. But the man who is convinced of his own worthlessness will be drawn to a woman he despises, because she will reflect his own secret self. She will release him from that objective reality in which he is a fraud. She will give him a momentary illusion of his own value and a momentary escape from the moral code that damns him. Observe the ugly mess which most men make of their sex lives, and observe the mess of contradictions which they hold as their moral philosophy. One proceeds from the other. Love is our response to our highest values, and can be nothing else. Let a man corrupt his values and his view of existence. Let him profess that love is not self-enjoyment but self-denial, that virtue consists not of pride but of pity or pain or weakness or sacrifice, that the noblest love is born not of admiration but of charity, not in response to values but in response to flaws, and he will have cut himself in two. His body will not obey him, it will not respond, it will make him impotent toward the woman he professes to love, and draw him to the lowest type of whore he can find. His body will always follow the ultimate logic of his deepest convictions. If he believes that flaws are values, he has damned existence as evil, and only the evil will attract him. He is damned himself, and he will feel that depravity is all he is worthy of enjoying. He has equated virtue with pain, and he will feel that vice is the only realm of pleasure. Then he will scream that his body has vicious desires of its own which his mind cannot conquer, that sex is sin, that true love is a pure emotion of the spirit. And then he will wonder why love brings him nothing but boredom and sex nothing but shame. You'd never accept any part of their vicious creed. You wouldn't be able to force it upon yourself. If you tried to damn sex as evil, you'd still find yourself, against your will, acting on the proper moral premise. You'd be attracted to the highest woman you met. You'd always want a heroine. You'd be incapable of self-contempt. You'd be unable to believe that existence is evil, and that you're a helpless creature caught in an impossible universe. You're the man who's spent his life shaping matter to the purpose of his mind. You're the man who would know that just as an idea unexpressed in physical action is contemptible hypocrisy, so is platonic love. And just as physical action unguided by an idea is a fool's self-fraud, so is sex when cut off from one's code of values. It's the same issue, and you would know it. Your inviolate sense of self-esteem would know it. You would be incapable of desire for a woman you despised. Only the man who extols the purity of a love devoid of desire is capable of the depravity of a desire devoid of love. But observe that most people are creatures cut in half, who keep swinging desperately to one side or to the other. One kind of half is the man who despises money, factories, skyscrapers, and his own body. He holds undefined emotions about non-conceivable subjects as the meaning of life and as his claim to virtue. And he cries with despair because he can feel nothing for the women he respects, but finds himself in bondage to an irresistible passion for a slut from the gutter. He is the man whom people call an idealist. The other kind of half is the man whom people call practical, the man who despises principles, abstractions, art, philosophy, and his own mind. He regards the acquisition of material objects as the only goal of existence, and he laughs at the need to consider their purpose or their source. He expects them to give him pleasure, and he wonders why the more he gets, the less he feels. He is the man who spends his time chasing women. Observe the triple fraud which he perpetrates upon himself. He will not acknowledge his need of self-esteem, since he scoffs at such a concept as moral values, yet he feels the profound self-contempt which comes from believing that he is a piece of meat. He will not acknowledge, but he knows that sex is the physical expression of a tribute to personal values, so he tries, by going through the motions of the effect, to acquire that which should have been the cause. He tries to gain a sense of his own value from the women who surrender to him, and he forgets that the women he picks have neither character nor judgment nor standard of value. He tells himself that all he's after is physical pleasure, but observe that he tires of his women in a week or a night, that he despises professional whores, and that he loves to imagine he is seducing virtuous girls who make a great exception for his sake. It is the feeling of achievement that he seeks and never finds. What glory can there be in the conquest of a mindless body? From each according to his ability, to each according to his need. This is the story of what happened at the 20th Century Motor Company, which put the above slogan into practice, as told by one of the survivors. Well, there was something that happened at that plant where I worked for 20 years. It was when the old man died and his heirs took over. There were 3 of them, 2 sons and a daughter, and they brought a new plan to run the factory. They let us vote on it, too, and everybody, almost everybody, voted for it. We didn't know. We thought it was good. No, that's not true either. We thought that we were supposed to think it was good. The plan was that everybody in the factory would work according to his ability, but would be paid according to his need. We voted for that plan at a big meeting with all of us present, 6,000 of us, everybody that worked in the factory. The Starnes heirs made long speeches about it, and it wasn't too clear, but nobody asked any questions. None of us knew just how the plan would work, but every one of us thought that the next fellow knew it. And if anybody had doubts, he felt guilty and kept his mouth shut, because they made it sound like anyone who'd opposed the plan was a child killer at heart, and less than a human being. They told us that this plan would achieve a noble ideal. Well, how were we to know otherwise? Hadn't we heard it all our lives from our parents and our school teachers and our ministers, and in every newspaper we ever read, and every movie, and every public speech? Hadn't we always been told that this was righteous and just? Well, maybe there's some excuse for what we did at that meeting. Still, we voted for the plan, and what we got, we had it coming to us. You know, ma'am, we are marked men in a way, those of us who lived through the 4 years of that plan in the 20th Century Factory. What is it that hell is supposed to be? Evil. Plain, naked, smirking evil, isn't it? Well, that's what we saw and helped to make, and I think we're damned, every one of us, and maybe we'll never be forgiven. Do you know how it worked, that plan, and what it did to people? Try pouring water into a tank where there's a pipe at the bottom, draining it out faster than you pour it. And each bucket you bring breaks that pipe an inch wider, and the harder you work, the more is demanded of you. And you stand slinging buckets 40 hours a week, then 48, then 56, for your neighbor's supper, for his wife's operation, for his child's measles, for his mother's wheelchair, for his uncle's shirt, for his nephew's schooling, for the baby next door, for the baby to be born, for anyone anywhere around you. It's theirs to receive, from diapers to dentures, and yours to work from sun up to sundown, month after month, year after year, with nothing to show for it but your sweat, with nothing in sight for you but their pleasure, for the whole of your life, without rest, without hope, without end, from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. We're all one big family, they told us. We're all in this together. But you don't all stand working in acetylene torch 10 hours a day together, and you don't all get a bellyache together. What's whose ability and which of whose needs comes first? When it's all one pot, you can't let any man decide what his own needs are, can you? If you did, he might claim that he needs a yacht. And if his feelings is all you have to go by, he might prove it, too. Why not? If it's not right for me to own a car until I've worked myself into a hospital ward, earning a car for every loafer and every naked savage on earth, why can't he demand a yacht from me, too, if I still have the ability not to have collapsed? No, he can't. Then why can he demand that I go without cream for my coffee until he's replastered his living room? Oh, well. Well, anyway, it was decided that nobody had the right to judge his own need or ability. We voted on it. Yes, ma'am, we voted on it in a public meeting 2x a year. How else could it be done? Do you care to think what would happen at such a meeting? It took us just one meeting to discover that we had become beggars. Rotten, whining, sniveling beggars, all of us. Because no man could claim his pay as his rightful earning. He had no rights and no earnings. His work didn't belong to him, it belonged to the family. And they owed him nothing in return, and the only claim he had on them was his need. So he had to beg in public for relief from his needs, like any lousy moocher, listing all his troubles and miseries down to his patched drawers and his wife's head colds, hoping that the family would throw him the alms. He had to claim miseries because it's miseries, not work, that had become the coin of the realm. So it turned into a contest among 6,000 panhandlers, each claiming that his need was worse than his brother's. How else could it be done? Do you care to guess what happened? What sort of men kept quiet, feeling shame, and what sort got away with the jackpot? But that wasn't all. There was something else that we discovered at the same meeting. The factory's production had fallen by 40% in that first half year, so it was decided that somebody hadn't delivered according to his ability. Who? How would you tell it? The family voted on that, too. They voted which men were the best, and these men were sentenced to work overtime each night for the next 6 months. Overtime without pay. Because you weren't paid by time, and you weren't paid by work, only by need. Do I have to tell you what happened after that, and into what sort of creatures we all started turning, we who had once been human? We began to hide whatever ability we had, to slow down and watch like hawks that we never worked any faster or better than the next fella. What else could we do when we knew that if we did our best for the family, it's not thanks or rewards that we'd get, but punishment? We knew that for every stinker who'd ruin a batch of motors and cost the company money, either through his sloppiness because he didn't have to care, or through plain incompetence, it's we who'd have to pay with our nights and our Sundays. So we did our best to be no good. There was one young boy who started out full of fire for the noble ideal. A bright kid without any schooling, but with a wonderful head on his shoulders. The first year he figured out a work process that saved us thousands of man-hours. He gave it to the family, didn't ask anything for it either, couldn't ask. But that was all right with him. It was for the ideal, he said. But when he found himself voted as one of our ablest and sentenced to night work because we hadn't gotten enough from him, he shut his mouth and his brain. You can bet he didn't come up with any ideas the second year. What was it they'd always told us about the vicious competition of the profit system, where men had to compete for who'd do a better job than his fellows? Vicious, wasn't it? Well, they should have seen what it was like when we all had to compete with one another for who'd do the worst job possible. There's no surer way to destroy a man than to force him into a spot where he has to aim at not doing his best, where he has to struggle to do a bad job day after day. That will finish him quicker than drink or idleness or pulling stick-ups for a living. But there was nothing else for us to do except to fake unfitness. The one accusation we feared was to be suspected of ability. Ability was like a mortgage on you that you could never pay off. And what was there to work for? You knew that your basic pittance would be given to you anyway, whether you worked or not. Your housing and feeding allowance, it was called. And above that pittance, you had no chance to get anything, no matter how hard you tried. You couldn't count on buying a new suit of clothes next year. They might give you a clothing allowance, or they might not, according to whether nobody broke a leg, needed an operation, or gave birth to more babies. And if there wasn't enough money for new suits for everybody, then you couldn't get yours either. There was one man who'd worked hard all his life because he'd always wanted to send his son through college. Well, the boy graduated from high school in the second year of the plan, but the family wouldn't give the father any allowance for the college. They said his son couldn't go to college until we had enough to send everybody's sons to college, and that we first had to send everybody's children through high school, and we didn't even have enough for that. The father died the following year in a knife fight with somebody in a saloon, a fight over nothing in particular. Such fights were beginning to happen among us all the time. Then there was an old guy, a widower with no family, who had one hobby, phonograph records. I guess that was all he ever got out of life. In the old days, he used to skip meals just to buy himself some new recording of classical music. Well, they didn't give him any allowance for records, personal luxury, they called it. But at that same meeting, Millie Bush, somebody's daughter, a mean, ugly little 8-year-old, was voted a pair of gold braces for her buck teeth. This was medical need because the staff psychologist had said that the poor girl would get an inferiority complex if her teeth weren't straightened out. The old guy who loved music turned to drink instead. He got so you never saw him fully conscious anymore. But it seems like there was one thing he couldn't forget. One night he came staggering down the street, saw Millie Bush, swung his fist and knocked all her teeth out. Every one of them. Drink, of course, was what we all turned to, some more, some less. Don't ask how we got the money for it. When all the decent pleasures are forbidden, there's always ways to get the rotten ones. You don't break into grocery stores after dark, and you don't pick your fellas' pockets to buy classical symphonies or fishing tackle. But if it's to get stinking drunk and forget, you do. Fishing tackle, hunting guns, snapshot cameras, hobbies. There wasn't any amusement allowance for anybody. Amusement was the first thing they dropped. Aren't you always supposed to be ashamed to object when anybody asks you to give up anything? If it's something that gave you pleasure? Even our tobacco allowance was cut to where we got 2 packs of cigarettes a month, and this, they told us, was because the money had to go into the baby's milk fund. Babies was the only item of production that didn't fall, but rose and kept on rising because people had nothing else to do, I guess, and because they didn't have to care. The baby wasn't their burden, it was the family's. In fact, the best chance you had of getting a raise and breathing easier for a while was a baby allowance. Either that or a major disease. It didn't take us long to see how it all worked out. Any man who tried to play straight had to refuse himself everything. He lost his taste for any pleasure. He hated to smoke a nickel's worth of tobacco or chew a stick of gum, worrying whether somebody had more need for that nickel. He felt ashamed of every mouthful of food he swallowed, wondering whose weary nights of overtime had paid for it, knowing that his food was not his by right, miserably wishing to be cheated rather than to cheat, to be a sucker but not a bloodsucker. He wouldn't marry, he wouldn't help his folks back home, he wouldn't put an extra burden on the family. Besides, if he still had some sort of sense of responsibility, he couldn't marry or bring children into the world when he could plan nothing, promise nothing, count on nothing. But the shiftless and the irresponsible had a field day of it. They bred babies. They got girls into trouble. They dragged in every worthless relative they had from all over the country, every unmarried pregnant sister for an extra disability allowance. They got more sicknesses than any doctor could disprove. They ruined their clothing, their furniture, their homes. What the hell, the family was paying for it. They found more ways of getting in need than the rest of us could ever imagine. They developed a special skill for it, which was the only ability they showed. God help us, ma'am, do you see what we saw? We saw that we'd been given a law to live by, a moral law, they called it, which punished those who observed it, for observing it. The more you tried to live up to it, the more you suffered. The more you cheated it, the bigger reward you got. Your honesty was like a tool left at the mercy of the next man's dishonesty. The honest ones paid, the dishonest collected. The honest lost, the dishonest won. How long could men stay good under this sort of law of goodness? We were a pretty decent bunch of fellows when we started. There weren't many chiselers among us. We knew our jobs and we were proud of it, and we worked for the best factory in the country, where old man Starnes hired nothing but the pick of the country's labor. Within 1 year under the new plan, there wasn't an honest man left among us. That was the evil. The sort of hell-horror evil that preachers used to scare you with, but you never thought to see alive. Not that the plan encouraged a few bastards, but that it turned decent people into bastards. And there was nothing else that it could do. And it was called a moral ideal. What was it we were supposed to want to work for? For the love of our brothers? What brothers? For the bums, the loafers, the moochers we saw all around us? And whether they were cheating or plain incompetent, whether they were unwilling or unable, what difference did that make to us? If we were tied for life to the level of their unfitness, faked or real, how long could we care to go on? We had no way of knowing their ability, we had no way of controlling their needs. All we knew was that we were beasts of burden, struggling blindly in some sort of place that was half hospital, half stockyards. A place geared to nothing but disability, disaster, disease. Beasts put there for the relief of whatever whoever chose to say was whichever's need. Love of our brothers. That's when we learned to hate our brothers for the first time in our lives. We began to hate them for every meal they swallowed, for every small pleasure they enjoyed. For one man's new shirt, for another's wife's hat, for an outing with their family for a paint job on their house. It was taken from us. It was paid for by our privations, our denials, our hunger. We began to spy on one another, each hoping to catch the others lying about their needs, so as to cut their allowance at the next meeting. We began to have stool pigeons who informed on people, who reported that somebody had bootlegged a turkey to his family on some Sunday, which he'd paid for by gambling, most likely. We began to meddle into one another's lives. We provoked family quarrels to get somebody's relatives thrown out. Anytime we saw a man starting to go steady with a girl, we made life miserable for him. We broke up many engagements. We didn't want anyone to marry. We didn't want any more dependents to feed. In the old days, we used to celebrate if somebody had a baby. We used to chip in and help him out with the hospital bills if he happened to be hard-pressed for the moment. Now, if a baby was born, we didn't speak to the parents for weeks. Babies to us had become what locusts were to farmers. In the old days, we used to help a man if he had a bad illness in the family. Now, well, I'll tell you about just one case. It was the mother of a man who had been with us for 15 years. She was a kindly old lady, cheerful and wise. She knew us all by our first names, and we all liked her. We used to like her. One day she slipped on the cellar stairs and fell and broke her hip. We knew what that meant at her age. The staff doctor said that she'd have to be sent to a hospital in town for expensive treatments that would take a long time. The old lady died the night before she was to leave for town. They never established the cause of death. No, I don't know whether she was murdered. Nobody said that. Nobody would talk about it at all. All I know is that I, and that's why I can't forget, I too had caught myself wishing that she would die. This, may God forgive us, was the brotherhood, the security, the abundance that the plan was supposed to achieve for us. Was there any reason why this sort of horror would ever be preached by anybody? Was there anybody who got any profit from it? There was. The Starnes heirs. I hope you're not going to remind me that they'd sacrificed a fortune and turned the factory over to us as a gift. We were fooled by that one, too. Yes, they gave up the factory, but profit, ma'am, depends on what it is you're after. And what the Starnes heirs were after, no money on earth could buy. Money is too clean and innocent for that. Eric Starnes, the youngest, he was a jellyfish that didn't have the guts to be after anything in particular. He got himself voted as director of our public relations department, which didn't do a thing, except that he had a staff for the not doing of anything, so he didn't have to bother sticking around the office. The pay he got, well, I shouldn't call it pay. None of us was paid. The alms voted to him was fairly modest, about 10 times what I got, but that wasn't riches. Eric didn't care for money. He wouldn't have known what to do with it. He spent his time hanging around among us, showing how chummy he was and democratic. He wanted to be loved, it seems. The way he went about it was to keep reminding us that he had given us the factory. We couldn't stand him. Gerald Starnes was our director of production. We never learned just what the size of his rake-off, his alms, had been. It would have taken a staff of accountants to figure that out, and a staff of engineers to trace the way it was piped, directly or indirectly, into his office. None of it was supposed to be for him. It was all for company expenses. Gerald had 3 cars, 4 secretaries, 5 telephones, and he used to throw champagne and caviar parties that no tax-paying tycoon in the country could have afforded. He spent more money in 1 year than his father had earned in profits in the last 2 years of his life. We saw a 100-pound stack, 100 pounds, we weighed them, of magazines in Gerald's office, full of stories about our factory and our noble plan, with big pictures of Gerald Starnes, calling him a great social crusader. Gerald liked to come into the shops at night, dressed in his formal clothes, flashing diamond cufflinks the size of a nickel, and shaking cigar ashes all over. Any cheap show-off who's got nothing to parade but his cash is bad enough, except that he makes no bones about the cash being his, and you're free to gape at him or not, as you wish. And mostly you don't. But when a bastard like Gerald Starnes puts on an act and keeps spouting that he doesn't care for material wealth, that he's only serving the family, that all the lushness is not for himself but for our sake and for the common good, because it's necessary to keep up the prestige of the company and of the noble plan in the eyes of the public, then that's when you learn to hate the creature as you've never hated anything human. But his sister Ivy was worse. She really did not care for material wealth. The alms she got was no bigger than ours, and she went about in scuffed, flat-heeled shoes and shirtwaists, just to show how selfless she was. She was our director of distribution. She was the lady in charge of our needs. She was the one who held us by the throat. Of course, distribution was supposed to be decided by voting, by the voice of the people. But when the people are 6,000 howling voices trying to decide without yardstick, rhyme, or reason, when there are no rules to the game and each can demand anything but has a right to nothing, when everybody holds power over everybody's life except his own, then it turns out, as it did, that the voice of the people is Ivy Starnes. By the end of the second year, we dropped the pretense of the family meetings. In the name of production efficiency and time economy, one meeting used to take 10 days, and all the petitions of need were simply sent to Miss Starnes' office. No, not sent. They had to be recited to her in person by every petitioner. Then she made up a distribution list, which she read to us for our vote of approval at a meeting that lasted 3/4 of an hour. We voted approval. There was a 10-minute period on the agenda for discussion and objections. We made no objections. We knew better by that time. Nobody can divide a factory's income among the thousands of people without some sort of a gauge to measure people's value. Her gauge was bootlicking. Selfless. In her father's time, all of his money wouldn't have given him a chance to speak to his lousiest wiper and get away with it, as she spoke to our best skilled workers and their wives. She had pale eyes that looked fishy, cold, and dead. And if you ever want to see pure evil, you should have seen the way her eyes glinted when she watched some man who'd talked back to her once and who'd just heard his name on the list of those getting nothing above basic pittance. And when you saw it, you saw the real motive of any person who's ever preached the slogan, "From each according to his ability, to each according to his need." This was the whole secret of it. At first I kept wondering how it could be possible that the educated, the cultured, the famous men of the world could make a mistake of this size and preach as righteousness this sort of abomination, when 5 minutes of thought should have told them what would happen if somebody tried to practice what they preached. Now I know that they didn't do it by any kind of mistake. Mistakes of this size are never made innocently. If men fall for some vicious piece of insanity when they have no way to make it work and no possible reason to explain their choice, it's because they have a reason that they do not wish to tell. And we weren't innocent either when we voted for that plan in the first meeting. We didn't do it just because we believed that the drippy old guff they spewed was good. We had another reason. But the guff helped us to hide it from our neighbors and from ourselves. The guff gave us a chance to pass off as virtue something that we'd be ashamed to admit otherwise. There wasn't a man voting for it who didn't think that under a setup of this kind, he'd muscle in on the profits of the men abler than himself. There wasn't a man rich and smart enough, but that he didn't think that somebody was richer and smarter, and this plan would give him a share of his betters' wealth and brain. But while he was thinking that he'd get unearned benefits from the men above, he forgot about the men below who'd get unearned benefits too. He forgot about all his inferiors who'd rush to drain him just as he hoped to drain his superiors. The worker who liked the idea that his need entitled him to a limousine like his boss's forgot that every bum and beggar on earth would come howling that their need entitled them to an icebox like his own. That was our real motive when we voted. That was the truth of it. But we didn't like to think it, so the less we liked it, the louder we yelled about our love for the common good. Well, we got what we asked for. By the time we saw what it was that we'd asked for, it was too late. We were trapped with no place to go. The best men among us left the factory in the first week of the plan. We lost our best engineers, superintendents, foremen, and highest skilled workers. A man of self-respect doesn't turn into a milk cow for anybody. Some able fellows tried to stick it out, but they couldn't take it for long. We kept losing our men. They kept escaping from the factory like from a pest hole, till we had nothing left except the men of need, but none of the men of ability. and the few of us who were still any good but stayed on were only those who had been there too long. In the old days, nobody ever quit the 20th century, and somehow we couldn't make ourselves believe that it was gone. After a while, we couldn't quit because no other employer would have us, for which I can't blame him. Nobody would deal with us in any way, no respectable person or firm. All the small shops where we traded started moving out of Starnesville fast, till we had nothing left but saloons, gambling joints, and crooks who sold us trash at gouging prices. The alms we got kept falling, but the cost of our living went up. The list of the factory's needy kept stretching, but the list of its customers shrank. There was less and less income to divide among more and more people. In the old days, it used to be said that the 20th century motor trademark was as good as the carat mark on gold. I don't know what it was that the Starnes heirs thought, if they thought at all, but I suppose that like all social planners and like savages, they thought that this trademark was a magic stamp which did the trick by some sort of voodoo power, and that it would keep them rich as it had kept their father. Well, when our customers began to see that we never delivered an order on time and never put out a motor that didn't have something wrong with it, the magic stamp began to work the other way around. People wouldn't take a motor as a gift if it was marked 20th century. And it came to where our only customers were men who never paid and never meant to pay their bills. But Gerald Starnes, doped by his own publicity, got huffy and went around with an air of moral superiority, demanding that businessmen place orders with us not because our motors were good, but because we needed the orders so badly. By that time, a village halfwit could see what generations of professors had pretended not to notice. What good would our need do to a power plant when its generators stopped because of our defective engines? What good would it do to a man caught on an operating table when the electric light went out? What good would it do to the passengers of a plane when its motor failed in midair? And if they bought our product not because of its merit, but because of our need, would that be the good, the right, the moral thing to do for the owner of that power plant, the surgeon in that hospital, the maker of that plane? Yet this was the moral law that the professors and leaders and thinkers had wanted to establish all over the earth. If this is what it did in a single small town where we all knew one another, do you care to think what it would do on a world scale? Do you care to imagine what it would be like if you had to live and to work when you're tied to all the disasters and all the malingering of the globe? To work, and whenever any men failed anywhere, it's you who would have to make up for it. To work with no chance to rise, with your meals and your clothes and your home and your pleasure depending on any swindle, any famine, any pestilence anywhere on earth. To work with no chance for an extra ration till the Cambodians have been fed and the Patagonians have been sent through college. To work on a blank check held by every creature born, by men whom you'll never see, whose needs you'll never know, whose ability or laziness or sloppiness or fraud you have no way to learn, and no right to question. Just to work and work and work, and leave it up to the Ivies and the Geralds of the world to decide whose stomach will consume the effort, the dreams, and the days of your life. And this is the moral law to accept? This a moral ideal? Well, we tried it, and we learned. Our agony took 4 years, from our first meeting to our last, and it ended the only way it could, in bankruptcy. At our last meeting, Ivy Starnes was the one who tried to brazen it out. She made a short, nasty, snippy little speech in which she said that the plan had failed because the rest of the country had not accepted it, that a single community could not succeed in the midst of a selfish, greedy world, and that the plan was a noble ideal, but human nature was not good enough for it. A young boy, the one who had been punished for giving us a useful idea in our first year, got up as we all sat silent and walked straight to Ivy Starnes on the platform. He said nothing. He spat in her face. That was the end of the noble plan and of the 20th century. The Forgotten Man of Socialized Medicine. This is the explanation given by a distinguished brain surgeon of why he joined Galt's strike. "I quit when medicine was placed under state control some years ago," said Dr. Hendricks. Do you know what it takes to perform a brain operation? Do you know the kind of skill it demands and the years of passionate, merciless, excruciating devotion that go to acquire that skill? That was what I would not place at the disposal of men whose sole qualification to rule me was their capacity to spout the fraudulent generalities that got them elected to the privilege of enforcing their wishes at the point of a gun. I would not let them dictate the purpose for which my years of study had been spent, or the conditions of my work, or my choice of patients, or the amount of my reward. I observed that in all the discussions that preceded the enslavement of medicine, men discussed everything except the desires of the doctors. Men considered only the welfare of the patients, with no thought for those who were to provide it. That a doctor should have any right, desire, or choice in the matter was regarded as irrelevant selfishness. His is not to choose, they said, only to serve. That a man who's willing to work under compulsion is too dangerous a brute to entrust with a job in the stockyards never occurred to those who proposed to help the sick by making life impossible for the healthy. I've often wondered at the smugness with which people assert their right to enslave me, to control my work, to force my will, to violate my conscience, to stifle my mind. Yet what is it that they expect to depend on when they lie on an operating table under my hands? Their moral code has taught them to believe that it is safe to rely on the virtue of their victims. Well, that is the virtue I have withdrawn. Let them discover the kind of doctors that their system will now produce. Let them discover in their operating rooms and hospital wards that it is not safe to place their lives in the hands of a man whose life they have throttled. It is not safe, if he is the sort of man who resents it, and still less safe if he is the sort who doesn't. The Nature of an Artist. This is an excerpt from a conversation between Dagny Taggart, the heroine of the story, and Richard Halley, a great composer who is now on strike. Miss Taggart, how many people are there to whom my work means as much as it does to you? That is the payment I demand. Not many can afford it. I don't mean your enjoyment. I don't mean your emotion. Emotions be damned. I mean your understanding, and the fact that your enjoyment was of the same nature as mine, that it came from the same source, from your intelligence, from the conscious judgment of a mind able to judge my work by the standard of the same values that went to write it. I mean not the fact that you felt, but that you felt what I wished you to feel. Not the fact that you admire my work, but that you admire it for the things I wish to be admired. There's only one passion in most artists more violent than their desire for admiration: their fear of identifying the nature of such admiration as they do receive. But it's a fear I've never shared. I do not fool myself about my work or the response I seek. I value both too highly. I do not care to be admired causelessly, emotionally, intuitively, instinctively, or blindly. I do not care for blindness in any form. I have too much to show. Or for deafness, I have too much to say. I do not care to be admired by anyone's heart, only by someone's head. And when I find a customer with that invaluable capacity, then my performance is a mutual trade to mutual profit. An artist is a trader, Miss Taggart, the hardest and most exacting of all traders. Do you see why I'd give 36 modern artists for one real businessman? Whether it's a symphony or a coal mine, all work is an act of creating and comes from the same source, from an inviolate capacity to see through one's own eyes, which means the capacity to perform a rational identification, which means the capacity to see, to connect, and to make what had not been seen, connected, and made before. That shining vision which they talk about as belonging to the authors of symphonies and novels, what do they think is the driving faculty of men who discover how to use oil, how to run a mine, how to build an electric motor? That sacred fire which is said to burn within musicians and poets, what do they suppose moves an industrialist to defy the whole world for the sake of his new metal? As the inventors of the airplane, the builders of the railroads, the discoverers of new germs or new continents have done through all the ages. An intransigent devotion to the pursuit of truth, Miss Taggart? Have you heard the moralists and the art lovers of the centuries talk about the artist's intransigent devotion to the pursuit of truth? Name me a greater example of such devotion than the act of a man who says that the earth does turn, or the act of a man who says that an alloy of steel and copper has certain properties which enable it to do certain things, that it is and does. And let the world rack him or ruin him, he will not bear false witness to the evidence of his mind. This, Miss Taggart, this sort of spirit, courage, and love for truth, as against a sloppy bum who goes around proudly assuring you that he has almost reached the perfection of a lunatic, because he's an artist who hasn't the faintest idea what his artwork is or means. He's not restrained by such crude concepts as being or meaning. He's the vehicle of higher mysteries. He doesn't know how he created his work or why. It just came out of him spontaneously, like vomit out of a drunkard. He did not think. He wouldn't stoop to thinking. He just felt it. All he has to do is feel. He feels. The flabby, loose-mouthed, shifty-eyed, drooling, shivering, uncongealed bastard. I, who know what discipline, what effort, what tension of mind, what unrelenting strain upon one's power of clarity are needed to produce a work of art. I, who know that it requires a labor which makes a chain gang look like rest, and a severity no army drilling sadist could impose. I'll take the operator of a coal mine over any walking vehicle of higher mysteries. The operator knows that it's not his feelings that keep the coal carts moving under the earth, and he knows what does keep them moving. Feelings? Oh, yes, we do feel. He, you, and I, we are, in fact, the only people capable of feeling, and we know where our feelings come from. But what we did not know, and have delayed learning for too long, is the nature of those who claim that they cannot account for their feelings. We did not know what it is that they feel. We are learning it now. It was a costly error, and those most guilty of it will pay the hardest price, as in justice they must. Those most guilty of it were the real artists, who will now see that they are first to be exterminated, and that they had prepared the triumph of their own exterminators by helping to destroy their only protectors. For if there is more tragic a fool than the businessman who doesn't know that he's an exponent of man's highest creative spirit, it's the artist who thinks that the businessman is his enemy. This is John Galt speaking. This is the philosophy of objectivism. "Ladies and gentlemen," said a voice that came from the radio receiver, a man's clear, calm, implacable voice, the kind of voice that had not been heard on the airwaves for years. "Mr. Thompson will not speak to you tonight. His time is up. I have taken it over. You were to hear a report on the world crisis. That is what you are going to hear. For 12 years you've been asking, who is John Galt? This is John Galt speaking. I am the man who loves his life. I am the man who does not sacrifice his love or his values. I am the man who has deprived you of victims and thus has destroyed your world. And if you wish to know why you are perishing, you who dread knowledge, I am the man who will now tell you. You have heard it said that this is an age of moral crisis. You have said it yourself, half in fear, half in hope that the words had no meaning. You have cried that man's sins are destroying the world, and you have cursed human nature for its unwillingness to practice the virtues you demanded. Since virtue to you consists of sacrifice, you have demanded more sacrifices at every successive disaster. In the name of a return to morality, you have sacrificed all those evils which you held as the cause of your plight. You have sacrificed justice to mercy. You have sacrificed independence to unity. You have sacrificed reason to faith. You have sacrificed wealth to need. You have sacrificed self-esteem to self-denial. You have sacrificed happiness to duty. You have destroyed all that which you held to be evil and achieved all that which you held to be good. Why then do you shrink in horror from the sight of the world around you? That world is not the product of your sins, it is the product and the image of your virtues. It is your moral ideal brought into reality in its full and final perfection. You have fought for it, you have dreamed of it, you have wished it, and I am the man who has granted you your wish. Your ideal had an implacable enemy which your code of morality was designed to destroy. I have withdrawn that enemy. I have taken it out of your way and out of your reach. I have removed the source of all those evils you were sacrificing one by one. I have ended your battle. I have stopped your motor. I have deprived your world of man's mind. Men do not live by the mind, you say? I have withdrawn those who do. The mind is impotent, you say? I have withdrawn those whose mind isn't. There are values higher than the mind, you say? I have withdrawn those for whom there aren't. While you were dragging to your sacrificial altars the men of justice, of independence, of reason, of wealth, of self-esteem, I beat you to it. I reached them first. I told them the nature of the game you were playing and the nature of that moral code of yours, which they had been too innocently generous to grasp. I showed them the way to live by another morality, mine. It is mine that they chose to follow. All the men who have vanished, the men you hated yet dreaded to lose, it is I who have taken them away from you. Do not attempt to find us. We do not choose to be found. Do not cry that it is our duty to serve you. We do not recognize such duty. Do not cry that you need us. We do not consider need a claim. Do not cry that you own us. You don't. Do not beg us to return. We are on strike. We, the men of the mind. We are on strike against self-immolation. We are on strike against the creed of unearned rewards and unrewarded duties. We are on strike against the dogma that the pursuit of one's happiness is evil. We are on strike against the doctrine that life is guilt. There is a difference between our strike and all those you've practiced for centuries. Our strike consists not of making demands, but of granting them. We are evil, according to your morality. We have chosen not to harm you any longer. We are useless, according to your economics. We have chosen not to exploit you any longer. We are dangerous and to be shackled, according to your politics. We have chosen not to endanger you, nor to wear shackles any longer. We are only an illusion, according to your philosophy. We have chosen not to blind you any longer and have left you free to face reality, the reality you wanted, the world as you see it now, a world without mind. We have granted you everything you demanded of us, we who had always been the givers but have only now understood it. We have no demands to present to you, no terms to bargain about, no compromise to reach. You have nothing to offer us. We do not need you. Are you now crying, no, this was not what you wanted? A mindless world of ruins was not your goal? You did not want us to leave you? You moral cannibals, I know that you've always known what it was that you wanted, but your game is up because now we know it too. Through centuries of scourges and disasters brought about by your code of morality, you have cried that your code had been broken, that the scourges were punishment for breaking it, that men were too weak and too selfish to spill all the blood it required. You damned men, you damned existence, you damned this earth, but never dared to question your code. Your victims took the blame and struggled on with your curses as reward for their martyrdom, while you went on crying that your code was noble, but human nature was not good enough to practice it. And no one rose to ask the question, good? By what standard? You wanted to know John Galt's identity. I am the man who has asked that question. Yes, this is an age of moral crisis. Yes, you are bearing punishment for your evil. But it is not man who is now on trial, and it is not human nature that will take the blame. It is your moral code that's through this time. Your moral code has reached its climax, the blind alley at the end of its course, and if you wish to go on living, what you now need is not to return to morality, you who have never known any, but to discover it. You have heard no concepts of morality but the mystical or the social. You have been taught that morality is a code of behavior imposed on you by whim, the whim of a supernatural power, or the whim of society, to serve God's purpose or your neighbor's welfare, to please an authority beyond the grave or else next door, but not to serve your life or pleasure. Your pleasure, you've been taught, is to be found in immorality. Your interests would best be served by evil, and any moral code must be designed not for you, but against you, not to further your life, but to drain it. For centuries, the battle of morality was fought between those who claimed that your life belongs to God and those who claimed that it belongs to your neighbors, between those who preached that the good is self-sacrifice for the sake of ghosts in heaven, and those who preach that the good is self-sacrifice for the sake of incompetence on earth. And no one came to say that your life belongs to you, and that the good is to live it. Both sides agreed that morality demands the surrender of your self-interest and of your mind, that the moral and the practical are opposites, that morality is not the province of reason, but the province of faith and force. Both sides agreed that no rational morality is possible, that there is no right or wrong in reason, that in reason there's no reason to be moral. Whatever else they fought about, it was against man's mind that all your moralists have stood united. It was man's mind that all your schemes and systems were intended to despoil and destroy. Now choose to perish, or to learn that the anti-mind is the anti-life. Man's mind is his basic tool of survival. Life is given to him. Survival is not. His body is given to him. Its sustenance is not. His mind is given to him. Its content is not. To remain alive, he must act, and before he can act, he must know the nature and purpose of his action. He cannot obtain his food without a knowledge of food and of the way to obtain it. He cannot dig a ditch or build a cyclotron without a knowledge of his aim and of the means to achieve it. To remain alive, he must think. But to think is an act of choice, the key to what you so recklessly call human nature. The open secret you live with, yet dread to name, is the fact that man is a being of volitional consciousness. Reason does not work automatically. Thinking is not a mechanical process. The connections of logic are not made by instinct. The function of your stomach, lungs, or heart is automatic. The function of your mind is not. In any hour and issue of your life, you are free to think or to evade that effort. But you are not free to escape from your nature, from the fact that reason is your means of survival, so that for you, who are a human being, the question to be or not to be is the question to think or not to think. A being of volitional consciousness has no automatic course of behavior. He needs a code of values to guide his actions. Value is that which one acts to gain and keep. Virtue is the action by which one gains and keeps it. Value presupposes an answer to the question of value to whom and for what. Value presupposes a standard, a purpose, and the necessity of action in the face of an alternative. Where there are no alternatives, no values are possible. There is only one fundamental alternative in the universe, existence or non-existence, and it pertains to a single class of entities, to living organisms. The existence of inanimate matter is unconditional. The existence of life is not. It depends on a specific course of action. Matter is indestructible. It changes its forms, but it cannot cease to exist. It is only a living organism that faces a constant alternative, the issue of life or death. Life is a process of self-sustaining and self-generated action. If an organism fails in that action, it dies. Its chemical elements remain, but its life goes out of existence. It is only the concept of life that makes the concept of value possible. It is only to a living entity that things can be good or evil. A plant must feed itself in order to live. The sunlight, the water, the chemicals it needs are the values its nature has set it to pursue. Its life is the standard of value directing its actions. But a plant has no choice of action. There are alternatives in the conditions it encounters. But there is no alternative in its function. It acts automatically to further its life. It cannot act for its own destruction. An animal is equipped for sustaining its life. Its senses provide it with an automatic code of action, an automatic knowledge of what is good for it, or evil. It has no power to extend its knowledge or to evade it. In conditions where its knowledge proves inadequate, it dies. But so long as it lives, it acts on its knowledge with automatic safety and no power of choice. It is unable to ignore its own good, unable to decide to choose the evil and act as its own destroyer. Man has no automatic code of survival. His particular distinction from all other living species is the necessity to act in the face of alternatives by means of volitional choice. He has no automatic knowledge of what is good for him or evil, what values his life depends on, what course of action it requires. Are you prattling about an instinct of self-preservation? An instinct of self-preservation is precisely what man does not possess. An instinct is an unerring and automatic form of knowledge. A desire is not an instinct. A desire to live does not give you the knowledge required for living. And even man's desire to live is not automatic. Your secret evil today is that that is the desire you do not hold. Your fear of death is not a love for life and will not give you the knowledge needed to keep it. Man must obtain his knowledge and choose his actions by a process of thinking which nature will not force him to perform. Man has the power to act as his own destroyer, and that is the way he has acted through most of his history. A living entity that regarded its means of survival as evil would not survive. A plant that struggled to mangle its roots, a bird that fought to break its wings, would not remain for long in the existence they affronted. But the history of man has been a struggle to deny and to destroy his mind. Man has been called a rational being, but rationality is a matter of choice, and the alternative his nature offers him is rational being or suicidal animal. This book is continued on Disc 5.